Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in the Standard, 4-star review in the Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Jolly. Welcome to the Chorley Little Theatre. Please welcome a man who's giving out free Chorley cakes. It's Richard Herring. Thanks a lot. Oh, God, you're much better than last week's audience. God, what a load of pricks. Welcome to Richard Herring's Lancashire's Smelliest Town podcast. Chorley has won again. It's won the honour again. I'm going to do it now. I'm going to read you the entry I wrote in my blog in 2010, maybe one of the first times I came to Chorley Little Theatre, the day after I went out to pay some money in the bank into the NatWest in Chorley. I wrote, "The shopping centre seemed to smell like a dirty crotch." But that might have been me. I hadn't had a shower yet because I was planning on exercising later. But I don't think my crotch was dirty enough to have created such a cloud of stink, so I'm pretty sure this is just how Chorley smells. But the fact the town smells like smegma only makes it more remarkable they have such a lovely and well-attended theatre. Though I do wonder if maybe the Chorleyans only go in there as it's the only place in Chorley that doesn't smell of unclean privates. So it's not just a joke, that acronym at the start. But I was down at The B Centre the other day, Chorley's B Centre. There's loads of bees. They asked themselves to be or not to be, and they decided to be. That's what they decided there. I tell you, that place has got quite a buzz. The buzz is saying, Rahulastapa. So there you go. good. I like to look at the local news when I come to a town. Today's news, and this might be useful for you in the audience, is that Moor Lane is closed as a tree has fallen in the road. That's the main headline. That's the main headline in Chorley. It's nice when you go to a place where that's the head. I mean, I guess they get fed up with just going, town centre smells of shit. I can't do it. I look up some facts on each of the places I go to. The main fact that seems to be about Chorley is that Chorley-born Miles Standish was a passenger on the Mayflower. Chorley seems very proud about this. It's the main fact I could see. That was a man who hated Chorley so much he was prepared to get on a dangerous ship to go and live somewhere where there are people shooting him with arrows. I wouldn't be so pleased about it. But well done for that. And Ian and Estelle are here at the Chorley Theatre always leave lots of nice things backstage. And they've commissioned a specially made Chorley cake for me, which is a Richard Herring Chorley cake. It's the herring variant, which includes... you may not know this story, but when I go to Edinburgh, I go to the Tempting Tatty, and there's a Richard Herring. My chosen one has become known as the Richard Herring, which is a jack potato with mango chutney and red cheddar cheese. So this is a Chorley cake, which I believe contains mango chutney and cheddar cheese. Unfortunately, I'm on a very restricted diet. I had one of these before, and it is fucking horrible. I still ate it all, though. Anyone like to try? Do you want to try? Oh, this lady, what's your name? Donna. Donna's going to try it. You're going to eat it live in front of us? You're giving it to him. What's your name? You were already eating something, Gray. You can't eat a Chorley cake with a mouthful of Haribo or whatever you've got. You've got Coca-Cola. This is a school trip. What's going on? Coca-Cola and crisps. He's going to eat the Chorley. He's eating the Chorley cake now. How is it? He's having a good bite. No problem. What do you think? Fine, isn't it? It's all right. I mean, it's against God and nature. But it's fine. Right. My guest this week. I'm away from home. Ooh. And I can't wait. I generally can't wait to go to sleep. And maybe sleep in past 6:30. Who knows? We'll see. My guest this week is probably best known for portraying an armed robber in Gobi Express. That's why we're here. Will you please welcome the amazing Tez Ilyas, ladies and gentlemen. Tez Ilyas. Tez Ilyas, local boy. Hello.
Hello.
Lovely to see you.
Good to see you as well. Thank you for having me.
It's my absolute pleasure. Tell us about being an armed robber in Gobi Express.
I'm going to try and remember where Gobi Express was first.
It's quite recent.
I remember it was during lockdown. Yeah. Oh, my God. Roll of my life. So it was a guy in Bradford. He's a puppeteer.
Yeah.
And he's got these puppets, a grandma and a granddad. And they run a local Gobi shop. Gobi's cauliflower in Punjabi. So like a local store, and they get stuck up one day by an armed robber, and I happen to be the armed robber who stuck them up for their money.
Wow! So I can see you being good at that role. I can see you doing that.
It's quite angry.
Yeah,
my best. It's good.
Yeah. Good. Have you ever handled a gun in real life?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. This summer actually.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I was just doing a bit of work experience in Syria, and I go every summer. It's quite good. If you know your way around, it's quite nice, and a lot of stories. I was in New Zealand doing SAS Who Dares Wins.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Spoilers: I did not win, and I'm not built for the SAS. As I found out, but yeah, one of the challenges was rescuing a hostage, so I got to handle a gun for that, which was fun.
Wow. Okay. Good. I'll watch myself then. I'm going to be careful. Look, I've had a lot of fun today watching your special, reading your brilliant book. Let's talk a little bit about your book first of all, because it's a good place to start because it's all about your childhood, basically. Mm-hmm. Really. So it's called The Secret Diary of a British Muslim Aged 13 3/4. So a little nod to Adrian Mole for the older people in the... I mean, we all know Adrian Mole, right? Even the many young people in the audience tonight have heard of that. What made you want to write about your childhood and why... It's an interesting format to choose the diary format as well.
I think the reason I chose the diary format is because I don't know how to write. and I thought instead of writing prose, I'll just write in a diary format. It seemed like a bit of a shortcut. But the idea came from the publishers themselves. I had an idea of writing a book sort of 5-6 years ago called Islam for Infidels. just sort of a dummy's guide to Islam, but with a provocative title that could be quite fun. And then maybe write a couple of sample chapters. Seemed like quite good fun. And then when the pandemic hit, the department I was working with in the publishers just thought, okay, we need people to write books now. And they came to me with the idea of writing a biography because I never thought anyone would be interested. And they sort of talked me into it.
Yeah. I think, but it's because the diary is not, you didn't actually write a diary. So, you know, you had to reconstruct the diary. I think that's harder than just writing it as a book, to say. I think because you've got to make sure the dates are right.
Yeah,
you've got to work out how you would have written.
I had a massive spreadsheet where I wrote the years across the top, all the months on the bottom, and then just tried to fill in as best I could from memory what would have happened then. And then the stuff that you shift around and you're like, that might have happened then, but I've got nothing for April 98. So I just pretend that thing happened in that month. I just place it there because I need something to write about in that month.
Yeah. And what I like about it is, and I'm sure this is intentional, is that, you know, and everyone's going to identify with lots of it because it's about adolescence and it's about the silly things we go through and the worries and, you know, writing about big subjects, then writing about little subjects as if they're sort of equal. But then obviously it's also got this extra element of, for me at least, where your upbringing is very different to my upbringing and what it is to be a Muslim in the UK and all the terrible things you've been through, as well as a look at what family life is like for Muslim people in the UK. So it's a really, you know, it draws you in. It makes you, you know, it feels like universal, but then equally it's an experience that hopefully, I guess you're writing for both audiences, right? Both for Muslims in the UK and people who need to learn about one.
Yeah, completely. When I finished the book, I genuinely looked at it and I thought, I wish I read something like this when I was a kid. I wish like someone in my dad's generation had written a book about what it was like growing up in the 70s.
Yeah.
And so it's a snapshot of a specific period of time in a specific town and what that was like for me as a British Pakistani lad. And there are some things that are completely universal.
Yeah.
Like fancying Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And then there are things that are slightly less universal, like rocking back and forth in mosque while you're reading the Quran, which I never realised I did until someone pointed it out to me and I was like, oh shit, yeah, I do that. Why am I doing this?
Well, it's, you know, even like straight away, it's quite instant packed because you get run over like in the first few pages.
Yeah.
There's sort of fights and various, you know, there's a great sort of story about you all trying to go and, I don't know what you're going to do to the sheep, but you're going to go and try to get to some sheep in a farm and the farmer sort of shooting at you, in the air.
So our high school was basically next to, there were two high schools, and between them were some woods and some farmland and stuff.
Yeah.
And so lunchtime was like an hour and 10 minutes. And so we always set ourselves a challenge of what is the furthest we can go into. Woods were out of bounds as well. So this is a bit of Park High School for anyone who knows it. And so woods were out of bounds anyway. So we just go and play in the woods. In my head, we were Famous Five, but I never said that out loud because the other boys probably would have punched me if I told them that I read. I got into Harry Potter because my older sister borrowed it from my younger cousin and she read it and she loved it. And I was like, I don't think I'm going to read a book about a wizard. And then she said, well, actually, our cousin Shiraz has read it as well. Now, at that point in my life, Shiraz, just a month ago, had gone into another school and hit someone in the head with a hammer.
Right.
And I thought, well, if Shiraz has read it, then it must be quite cool then. So I... And that's why I read Harry Potter 1, because my cousin Thor had read it. But these woods were sort of in between these two schools, and we just had the idea, like, could we reach the other school and be back in time? The answer is no, but there was one time where we saw some sheep and, you know, like, we weren't doing anything ungodly to the sheep, but, you know, we were chasing them around because we were young lads. And then there was a farmer who had a shotgun who just hit one blast into the air, and we just our ears were ringing and we just fled in all different directions, and some of us got caught and some of us never.
Yeah. So that's all very exciting. And then there's, you know, and then there's the stuff that, you know, it's interesting because even though, you know, I'm interested in religion and I'm interested in this subject, I realise how little I know about Islam really and about what goes on. So all that stuff's very interesting and what the family life is and what the, you know, the, like you say, the mosque things. I think the thing that really caught my attention, both in this, in the book and in your Radio 4 show, was the shaving aspect of Islam, which I was not aware of. The things that you have to shave.
Yeah. So for those of you that don't know, in Islam, men and women have to remove our pubic hair and armpit hair. So that's a thing that we do. So yeah,
it's, is that where this started for men? Because guys never used to win there. And
possibly.
In the '70s, everyone had bushes and women had bushes. I can't remember the last time I saw a proper thatch.
I don't think many Muslim bushes were captured in the '70s.
No, I'm not. I'm talking generally. But then now guys have started doing it as well. So
we started that. Yeah, the trend that we thought came from pornography came from us.
Yeah.
So yeah, we did that. But it's weird for me because I'm a very hairy man. I've got one tattoo and it's off Chewbacca, just from head to toe. And so shaving certain areas does then make it look quite odd, I think.
Yeah.
Like an elephant creeping out of a bush. So yeah, it's a bit odd when I shave some areas and I'm like, but I'm just so hairy everywhere else. It's weird.
And the first time you had to do that, you sort of write about doing it in the bath and and clogging up the bath and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was too embarrassed to ask anyone.
Yeah.
Didn't have a good relationship with my stepdad. Didn't then also have a good relationship with my own dad. Or I just not close enough to be like, how do I shave my dick? And so you just kind of go, well, let's just do it.
Yeah.
So I just started doing it. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, it's that such a human story and a human moment, but also like what kind of mind blowing as well. So it's great. So those things I think are just terrific. But then also obviously on the other side is the racism that you faced as well, which I think you know you cover really well because it's not you know it's not it's a part of this book. It's not you know it would be easy I'm sure to write a book that was about the racism that you encountered, and it wouldn't be as it's not a light touch because that's not the right way of saying it, but you know what I mean. It's not
it's not pervading
the whole thing.
Dominate our lives. No. It's sort of look back at retrospectively and go, oh my god, there was a lot of awful shit going on.
Yeah,
but at the time when you're living through it, you never think that. And I mean, unless you're in like a literal war zone or something, you never think your life is that bad because you become conditioned to your own experiences, and so whatever is happening in your life, because it's happened to people around you and to everyone in your community, is kind of just normal.
Yeah, sure.
And these weren't everyday stories. These weren't things that you're doing every day, people coming and going, oh, this happened and this happened. It just, you know, it happened now and again.
Yeah. And, you know, I suppose, but all the world of, I mean, it's interesting, the world events that happened, and a lot of big world events happened in those years. I mean, the Princess Diana dying and there's a sort of... Well, you're a student. You're a clever guy at school, but you've got a big mouth, I think it would be fair to say.
Yeah.
So there's when Jill Dando dies, you sort of make an inappropriate joke about Jill Dando that you get into a lot of trouble for. And then obviously 9/11 is sort of towards the end of the book.
It's the headliner.
Yeah. But that obviously had a huge impact. Obviously.
Yeah.
I mean. I nearly did the same joke as you did about children, on your lives,
it was interesting because I straight after 9/11 I went to university. It was literally I think 2 or 3 weeks later, so I was 18 and a half to keep to the theme of the book. And yeah, I went to uni, and it was just so weird because I had come from this very insular Pakistani Muslim community, and all the school was quite mixed, everything else really wasn't, and then suddenly thrust into Lancaster up the road, and very, very middle class, very white. Everyone who wasn't white was a foreign student. Suddenly I'm best friends with people from all over the country, from all walks of life, from different classes and stuff that I'd never really thought about. And just some of those lads had such dark senses of humour, which I think really helped me shape into sort of what I eventually became.
Yeah.
Because they were cracking all sorts of 9/11 jokes and stuff that then kind of bizarrely just made me more comfortable. I was like, oh, this is lads.
Yeah.
This is sort of stuff that we laugh about at home. It was
of
just,
course.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, and humour, it's interesting, isn't it, how humour can, I mean, it can be used to pull people apart, and it can be used to bring people together.
Yeah,
and almost the same. Sometimes the same joke. It's just the way it's told, or Or, yeah, how much you trust the person, you know, how you like the person.
It's completely, it happens all the time where a joke in a room is received in a certain way.
Yeah.
And then you pour it on YouTube and then suddenly the whole world can see it and it's received differently. And you're like, oh, hang on. But in the room, people were fine.
Yeah.
But just, it's not in the room anymore.
Yeah.
People then tend to not enjoy it as much sometimes.
Sure. And I quite like the fact that you went to, you studied biochemistry at university,
yeah,
just as sort of anthrax was being sent in the post.
Yeah, so there were like jokes to make about that and
yeah,
stuff. It was just, yeah, it was a fun period for dog jokes.
Yeah. Yeah, if only there could be another 9/11.
Yeah, honestly.
If only something would happen.
Very good for my career.
Yeah. And it feels like something that, you know, could easily be, I mean, the book, it feels like something that could easily be a television series or a film. Has there been any interest in sort of taking
There has a little bit. We are working with a production company to try and turn it into maybe a TV show and stuff. It's just so hard. I mean, yeah, you'll know, it's so hard to get stuff made.
It is.
Doesn't matter if you've got great ideas or not. I mean, the stuff we see on TV that we're like, how did that get made? And
yeah,
I think some, now that I'm in it trying to get stuff made, just think about how much, not speaking for myself, but speaking on behalf of our fraternity, how much good stuff doesn't get made.
Yeah.
Because just for whatever reason, there's not a budget for it, or there's not a vision for it, or this has probably happened to you as well, where you take a project so far along and then the commissioner who loved your idea changes. And then they've got their own idea of what should be on their channel, and then your stuff gets pulled to the back. So hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, it's endlessly happened to me. Yeah. So if you take too long to write your scripts,
yeah,
then there's someone else and go, well, I'm not doing this. This was someone else's commission. So yeah, I mean, you know, great things do get through, obviously, but you know, there's a lot of competition. I think there's so many people trying to do things now, but equally, there's that bit of luck. You need the right person to see it, the person who gets it, person who gives you the chance, you know. So yeah, there's so much luck in it. But it does feel like, you know, it feels necessary as well, because I just think it, you know, if I don't know about Islam, then most people don't, you know, most white people in the UK don't know enough about it, or have preconceptions about it and you clearly are a religious person still, you know. Which a lot of comedians, myself included, we brought up religious and then turn against it. But that you haven't,
no,
the comedy hasn't.
Muslims don't do that.
No.
Well, no, that's not true. Yeah, I have friends who aren't practicing. But yeah, I was brought up in a very, actually, let me take that back. I wasn't brought up in a very religious household, but I was brought up in a believing household.
Yeah.
And I think weirdly, the more sort of Islamophobia and racism there's been kind of post 9/11, the closer it's brought people to their religion.
Yeah.
So I kind of almost think that sort of, in the same way that if you tell people they're stupid for thinking Brexit's a good idea, it's not going to change their minds.
No.
In the same way, if you tell a religious person they're stupid for being religious, it's, if anything, is going to make me double down. I'm like, all right, well, I'll be stupid then.
But you are admitting that you are stupid to be religious.
Yeah, no.
You're as stupid as someone who believes in Brexit. That's good. As long as we have that established.
I'll maintain a dignified silence.
But no, it's, you know, but I also think it's impressive to believe in anything, really. And it's impressive to stay true to that. And, you know, I think, all of your stuff is about, you know, you're quite a brave comedian. You're doing risque material and you're taking some chances. But it's all about family, and it's about sticking together, and it's, you know, and it's about, you know, it's about changing people's minds as well about what they're getting. But it doesn't feel like in your special, which again is available online for free. People can watch that for free. So do go and watch it. The Tez Talks, is it that one? That's the one.
Yeah, Tez Talks. Yeah,
Which is great. I watched that today. You know, that's you play around with these ideas and back with the racism and with, you know, even the seriousness of the subject. There's a great bit where you sort of do a really serious, what feels like the end of the show. It's very serious, and then you take the piss out of that as well. So, you know, you've got this playful spirit with it. So you're still very much a challenging comedian, and so it's, you know, it's quite good to be getting that from a position of faith, I think.
Yeah, I always in my stand up, I've always wanted to be universal. I've never wanted to alienate anyone. I've never wanted anyone to think that this wouldn't be a show for them. So I've always wanted to be the sort of comic that anyone from any background could come and watch. And it just so happens that the things that I like talking and joking about are things that I care about and are related to my lived experiences. But I think that's the case for most comedians.
Yeah.
I would love to do what McIntyre does. I would love to be able to, like, you know, have an experience on an escalator and and be able to turn that into 10 minutes of just the material. Like, I would, my mind doesn't think that way, and I'm sure his mind doesn't think the way that mine does, but, you know, I think he's doing better than I am. But I think it would, I would love to be like that observational guy who's just, you know, who has his experiences and they can turn that into a 15-minute thing, but it's just not how my mind works. So my mind works the way it does, and I try and bring that to audiences, and most audiences that watch it do enjoy it, so it sort of keeps you going.
Yeah, but again, it's great. There's a lot of comedians doing, you're putting that those specials up for free, so people can go and find them, and, you know, and so it's a really great thing to do. I think in terms of just bringing an audience to it, and it's you know it's getting harder to monetize anyway, so you might as well give it out for free and then promote the next tour in the show. I mean, this, you know, again, this is near the top of that show. You talk about kind of a leaflet you've got the Punisher Muslim Day thing, Punisher which again Muslim feels Day. Feels like it, you know, it feels like so extreme that, I mean, you wring the humor out of it as well, but it's kind of terrifying as well, this idea.
Yeah, I remember when I started, so it's Punisher Muslim Day was this leafleting campaign started by this, I think they eventually caught him, he lived in Lincolnshire, I think, of course. And and he just sent this letter basically detailing how he'd want to punish Muslims, and it's quite graphic, to like MPs, other famous Muslims, like media figures and stuff, and then to just random households around the country. And then people were scared, but I immediately found it funny. Like, I just read it and I thought, this is so funny. And I took it on stage that night, and the bit that you see in the show was, I think 80% of it was improvised.
Right.
That night, just going on stage and just talking through it line by line.
Yeah.
And then I thought, this could be a bit, actually.
And yeah, because it's sort of about awarding points for the more extreme things. Yeah. But, like,
There's no logic.
Logic to have the point system, which I think is the funny thing to figure out when you're talking about the burning down mosques and things like that, which would be, you know, is obviously like an horrific idea.
I think one of them was something like, throw acid in the face of a Muslim.
Yeah.
And then there's only 50 points.
Yeah.
And my point was, that's just not enough points for what is potentially a 15-year jail sentence. You'd want more points for that risk, wouldn't you? So I just thought it didn't really stand up to scrutiny.
And then nuclear bomb.
Yeah,
the Middle East was
the last one. And I thought, well, surely at that point you just won. Like, you can't. Because that one was 2,500 points. And I thought, no, surely just, like, if I've accumulated loads of other points doing everything else, but someone's nuked Mecca, you can't give me the victory. You can't be like, well, but he threw a lot of acid. So big enough to give him the victory.
It's just
the whole thing hit me up so much.
It's just the idea of anyone managing that. Everyone else will be like, oh, I only pushed someone over. Like, for
I feel like Victor Crumb at the end of Harry Potter, but when he catches the golden snitch, but he doesn't win the game. Like, surely that would mean you win. Oh, it's fine.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress. It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered.
Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You must have been trouble for the teachers. I think, yeah. What's this story where you say your friend had broken his neck? Do you remember this bit? In the book?
So my best friend, who I sat with every single day of high school, he just didn't turn up to school one day. And this was pre-mobile phone, so I had no idea why he hadn't turned up to school. And then when you're at school, your teacher always asks you why your friend's not in. Do you remember? You're like, why is Tom not in? You're like, I don't know. But on this particular occasion, I just went, oh, Missy's broken his neck. And as soon as I said it, I thought, I've just chosen the wrong thing here. Because her face dropped and she was, and I was like, oh, sh-. And I just had to be like, yeah. And she went, that's really serious. And I went, yeah. It's really bad, yeah. And then he came in the next day and I was like, you don't have to pretend you've broken your neck. But then at every class, because your tutor group, then obviously you're in a lot of classes with them. Like every time the teacher's like, you know, when you go to your next class, biology or whatever, and the teacher's like, oh, where's Hassim? And then Fiona's like, oh, Tez knows. And I'm like, oh, yeah, he's broken his neck, miss. And the teacher's like, he might be paralyzed. And in my head, I'm like, yeah, he might. I hope he's not.
It's just the lovely, the short-termism of it. Of just like, you know, not even thinking, how am I going to get out of this? I just love it. It's just, you know, but again, it exemplifies humanity. Is what, you know, is what you were like, one was like as a kid.
Yeah.
I was the lab math kid at school, so I completely get it. So, you know, you were sort of, in the book, you're sort of talking about wanting to be a doctor. You kind of ended up working in the civil service.
Mm.
So how did you segue away from that into doing the comedy? What was the...
So I think the doctor thing was always an ambition I had as a kid. And I don't know if that was whether that come from me organically or whether my mum incepted it in my mind when I was asleep one day. But I'd always wanted to be a doctor was the thing. And then I think I was always told you need 6 A's at GCSE, 6 A's. That's what you need. Managed to get those in this very, very rough school that I went to. And then just got thrown out of home between sort of school and college. And then just kind of, I didn't really go off the rails. I just kind of took my eye off the ball and I just started coasting at college. And I didn't have, and my mum was a real dragon mum, sort of made sure I did my homework and was on top of me all the time and stuff. And then I just didn't have that anymore.
Yeah.
And so I kind of just let it relax and just thought I could get by on how clever I thought I was.
Yeah.
Which was not enough. And so I just really, really flunked my A-levels, which ended up putting me through clearing. So I did biochemistry at Lancaster.
Yeah.
And then by the time I'd finished the degree, I'd really just fallen out of love with science and just didn't fancy working in a hospital or a lab or something. So then...
So civil service.
Well, I just started looking at graduate jobs.
Yeah.
And what graduate jobs could I get with a tutu? And it sort of limits your choices a little bit. So the civil service, the FAST stream, which is the civil service graduate program, does accept a tutu, and it's one of the most prestigious programs in the country. And so I applied for it, and I somehow managed to get on. And like all of my friends tried as well, and none of them could pass the tests. And so, is anyone here who's tried the FAST stream?
I did.
Did you get in?
No.
Dickhead. So it's quite hard to get in. Only the brightest and the best get in.
This lady said she passed the test. Yeah, she passed the test.
It didn't play into my narrative, so I can't remember what she said.
Very keen for everyone to know.
No, I was lucky. I got lucky and I got into the civil service. And
but then you didn't, you know, but then you left the civil service to become a comedian. I mean, what was it? I mean, you were obviously funny as a kid and you were obviously like smart, you know, smart and maybe smart ass as a kid.
Yeah.
So was that, but, you know, I get it. Doesn't feel like that would have been a natural, as it didn't for me. It didn't feel like that's the career progression that you might be going on.
No, it wasn't, but like I had no other ambitions really. I mean, yeah. I never thought from where I come from in Blackburn. I've said this once I started working in this career that I know more people in prison and have gone to work in the arts in Blackburn. Right. So there was no sort of role models or even scope. Even at school, there was no one who even entertained a career in music. Even like, you know, another kid in the class who was like, oh, I fancy working in... There was no one, literally no one in the whole school did anything of note in terms of being in the arts or anything.
Yeah.
So it just wasn't on my radar whatsoever. So just being in the civil service and climbing that ladder was as much about... was as much ambition as I had. And, you know, there's fantastic careers in the civil service and I was working on some quite cool stuff. Like, I worked on the Olympics for 3 years.
Right.
And that was cool. Like, my discus didn't medal. but I worked in security for keeping the Olympics safe and secure. So,
right.
Do you remember the 2012 Olympics? Do you remember how there was no terrorist attacks? You're welcome. And... So I did that, and there's a lot of cool experiences came from that. And then, but I think it was 2 years in. So I'd gone down to London, came back up for a couple of years to work in Liverpool, and then went back to London again. And just that second time round, I was just like, I just need to make some friends. So I started looking online for stuff that I could do, started Googling writing workshops, and that's when I came across a stand-up workshop.
Right.
And I thought, never thought about it before. Well, that's a lie. I had thought about it watching like Eddie Murphy and thinking, oh, but just something that I just happened to be the right place, right time. Found this thing, had enough money in my bank account, and I just thought I'm just gonna go for it. And that was January 2010.
Right.
So I did the workshop in April, and then that summer, June 2010, was my first ever gig.
Right.
And so I balanced both for about 6.5 years, because obviously, as you know, the open mic circuit does not pay.
It does not pay very much.
And so 6.5 years, I did. That was my apprenticeship.
Yeah.
So my first two Edinburghs, I had my full time job.
Right. And so you just managed to work the time.
Yeah, I had very nice, very, very lovely, understanding land managers who gave me the summer off.
Right.
Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, but it feels like it's been a rapid success. But I suppose, you know, it is still, that's still 13 years of work. So it's a long work. But you know, the special that's online is, you know, it feels like a very accomplished piece of work. You know, it's a very, you know, it feels like someone who's been doing it for longer than that, I would say, really, to be honest. But yeah, but it's, at what point did you sort of think, yeah, this is, what was the thing that made you think I can quit the day job?
It was just money, really. I don't come from money. I've never asked anyone for financial help at home because they wouldn't be in a position to offer it. And so it was that point where I could make enough money if I left my job and quit London.
Yeah.
So quitting London was the key as well.
Right.
Even though now I'm super glad that I did. But at the time, I didn't want to leave London.
No.
But it was the only way that I could have made the job. Sort of leaving job work.
Okay, so that's interesting. So the return to... You live in Blackburn
yeah.
now.
So
you've gone back to Blackburn.
Yeah.
So that was more a financial thing than...
And plus my mum was on her own as well, so I thought, go and look after mum.
Yeah.
Not that she needs looking after, but, you know.
Yeah.
Just be around.
Is it... You know, again, a lot of people would have gone the other way, right? They would have think, I'm going to be a famous comedian. I can now leave Blackburn and live somewhere nice. like Chorley. that's, you know, I think it says a lot about someone. Again, I think, you know, as much as you're saying that it made sense to leave London and you didn't want to leave London, a lot of people wouldn't make that journey in the opposite direction and wouldn't go back to their childhood home or childhood hometown and live there. So
yeah, but at that point I had nothing to prove in London in terms of stand-up. So there was nowhere I needed to go and do open mic spots at or open spots at. Every club I needed to be in with, I was in with.
Yeah.
Or weren't going to book me. So there was nothing, stand-up-wise, there was no reason to be in London other than when I was booked for shows. Then it came about, like, meetings and TV and all that sort of stuff. And luckily, we had that great pandemic in which... people learned that you don't need to be in the same room to have a meeting.
Yes.
So that was one of the silver linings of the pandemic was Zoom, I think.
Yeah.
So that's helped a lot. Because people just drag you down for like these 20-minute meetings for so many things they don't do anymore, thank God.
Yeah, with Limmy, the first time Limmy was on, who's from Glasgow, he was brought down from Glasgow to London to be told they weren't going to make his show. then had to go home again. That's sort of funny. Which is very typical of TV executives, but absolutely unbelievable. You'll just think, I'll write him a letter. Yeah. I'll ring him up and tell him.
He doesn't need to come down.
But the TV, you know, you've done loads of TV stuff. I'm kind of interested in the Tezza Clock Show because the bits I've seen of that are really great. But it was it quite a short lived.
It ended up becoming a pandemic casualty.
So it was
always been an ambition of mine to, you know, have a TV show with your name in the title. And I was a big fan of Jon Stewart and all the sorts of things that you get in America. And finally given the opportunity. And Channel 4 were great. They let me just get on with it. And it was kind of what ended up on TV was kind of like 80, 90% of what I wanted the show to be, which is more than you can possibly dream of having in terms of creative control. And I got to have mates on the show like Adam Raw and Sindhu V and Sophie Willen, who've all gone left me behind. But it was such a fun thing to do. But they basically gave us an extended pilot run instead of one show for a pilot. They gave us three episodes, so almost like a mini season. And we put them out, and people who watched it enjoyed it. Was very critically well received. And then, you know, you end up in the meetings of like, where do they go next? What needs improving? And in the umming and ahhing, the pandemic hit. And then there's no point asking the question in the pandemic. And then after the pandemic, it just seemed like that ship had sailed. And it's kind of...
Yeah, that's a shame.
Channel 4 have no money anymore.
Yes, that's also true. It's a real shame because I think it did, you know, it did feel like, you know, I was actually surprised when I went to look for it. I'd seen bits of it and I thought, oh, this is good, and it seems to get good game reviews, and I couldn't believe that there was so little of it, you know. So that's an amazing sign that you're onto something, because usually something's three episodes, people go, oh, it's three episodes, you know, and we don't remember it. So there might be, it feels like.
It'd be nice, but I've kind of, one thing the pandemic told me, and this is again coming back to sort of being religious, there is a thing in Islam which is like, if something is meant to be, it will happen. I'm paraphrasing. But if something is meant to be, it will happen. And if it's not, it's just not meant for you. And I've just thrown myself into that. I'm like, if these things are meant for me, they will happen for me. There's nothing that can stop it. And if it's not meant for me, I'll try. And if it doesn't happen, fine.
Yeah.
And it's just made getting rejection a lot easier to process.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of comedians need that. So if you could convert a few of us to that way of thinking.
I don't need a competition.
I mean, you know, the important point of that is to try. because it'd be easy to sit back and go, whatever happens will happen. You've got to try. Mm. But I think that, you know, regardless of faith, that's a sensible way of looking at it.
And, you know, like I said, luck plays such a tremendous part in these things. I've kind of made my peace with it. But if it does happen again or something similar, of course I'd love that.
Cool. Yeah, well, I'm sure it will. I'm sure it will. It was really good. Let me ask you some emergency questions before I forget to do that, because I'm going to... let's see what we've got. I'm going to go back to early on in the emergency questions canon. This is 1001 emergency questions. This is the first one that's come up, so I'm going to ask you this. Would you rather date a man who is a 6-foot-tall penis or a man who, instead of having a penis, has a tiny man down there? So you have to date one of these two fellows. One of them's a 6-foot-tall penis, but he doesn't have anything else. Doesn't even have balls.
Just a penis.
Just a penis. He shuffles along like a slug. he's got a face on his helmet.
Right. Is he circumcised?
would that be a deal breaker for you if he's not?
It would potentially.
I don't like to do it to him because it's sort of like his
role. It's like a haircut.
If it's like a haircut, it's okay. But if it's like his, you know, part of his neck's been cut off, it seems a bit worse. or a man who's, instead of having a penis, has a tiny man, another tiny man down there. So it's like two men in a way.
I'll go for the second option. I'll go for the man squared.
Okay.
I'll go for the man plus little man.
Yeah.
I think that could be quite fun.
I think it'd be nice to have, you know,
company. Yeah, if it pisses me off, I'll be like, let's fucking tell him. Stop dicking about. Sorry, no offence.
Good. Have you ever seen a ghost? Ooh, he has. He's looking at one now.
think so.
Yeah.
I was in... So when my mum got remarried in Pakistan, I would have been 4 years old, 4 or 5 years old. And she got married to a man who lived on the other side of the village. I was living in my grandma's house. And I didn't really understand what was going on. I don't think I even realized mum got remarried. I think I just didn't... She just wasn't in the house anymore.
Right.
So I was just very confused. But I did know she was living on the other side of the village. And this village wasn't big. It was like, you know, probably the size of a shopping center. And I sneaked out of the house dead at night. This was in the 80s in Pakistan, so there was no electricity in the village. So pitch black was pitch black. And snuck out the house, kind of knew my way around the village, sort of a bit of light from the stars and stuff, but very, 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 very dark. And I remember turning into one alley, and as I turned in, a figure stepped out from the other side of the alley. And I don't mean, like, he didn't turn in, he stepped out. So I just froze and kind of just looked at this figure, and it looked human. It was a human figure. I just looked at him, panicked, didn't say anything, and just turned back and just ran.
Right.
Just ran home. And now I'm old, I'm like, how do you even know how late it was? It could have been past midnight, could have been 8 p.m. I have no idea. So it could have just been someone on their normal sort of just walking around the village or going or doing the reverse journey that I was doing. Or I saw a ghost, I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay.
But I was terrified. There was no one else awake. But I think the thing that I remember is that this, it stepped out. It didn't...
Scared that guy. Yeah, scared the life out of that guy.
But it didn't turn into the alley.
Yeah.
It stepped out as I turned in.
Yeah.
It stepped out, and that always stays with me. And I'm like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, why did it step out and not turn in? Yeah. So that's what always makes me think that maybe it was
a ghost.
Maybe it was a ghost, yeah.
Or just a drunk man.
It was a ghost, Richard.
Good. So look, you're doing a new show. Have you started work on your new show? Is this Populous?
Populist
was, became
my last show, which became Testify, I think.
Okay. Well, so what's the new tour called?
So the new tour is called After Eight.
Okay.
So it's because I played a character called Eight in Man Like Mobeen.
Of course you did.
Yeah. Which is not in anymore. Spoilers. And so the show is called After Eight to reference that it's after that. And also, the show starts at 8, so you know. So that will be on sale in 2 weeks' time,
okay,
including in this room. So please do buy tickets, and it'll be all over the country if you're listening at home, which most of you are.
Hopefully,
all over the country.
Hopefully, more at home than in here. Fucking hell.
So I'll be all over the country. TezIlias.com for tickets, those tickets go on sale on the 1st of December, I think.
Right, and the tour's like later in 2024.
Yeah, so September 2024 till December 2024. Yeah, autumn 2024.
So how far is the show now? Do you know what the show is? Are you working on it?
Ish.
Yeah.
I think I've got about 20 minutes.
Okay.
Of serviceable material.
Just do it really slow.
But yeah.
That's what Stuart Lee does.
Tell each bit. Tell each bit 3 times.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think I know what the show's about-ish. But it doesn't really have a grand theme. I think I've kind of moved away from writing the shows where it kind of had a grand structure, and I just want to tell jokes.
Sure.
Sort of just do some routines, and if there's probably a loose thread that might hang through it and stuff. But yeah, I don't want to do a big ambitious sort of structured show.
Yeah.
I've kind of moved away from that, I think.
And do you know, obviously you've done lots of different things. You're an acting, presenting, and, you know, do you feel like stand-up's the main thing? Is that what you keep going back to, or is it just part of the...
Yeah, I always say stand-up is my wife and acting is my mistress.
Okay.
that's the way I say it. Everything else comes second. Stand-up is always...
Yeah.
..is always first for me.
Because it's kind of easy, you know, like once you start getting some TV gigs and TV money and, you know, getting on a panel show or your own show, it kind of becomes easy to go, I don't need to do... You know, writing a stand-up show is... harder in a lot of ways than doing things like that.
Yeah, it's more exposing, it's more lonely, it's more tiring. But then also the rewards for it are like nothing else I've experienced. The sort of being in the room once you've finished writing your show and you're touring it, or even just in the clubs when, you know, you've written a bit and you go to the clubs, and the energy in clubs are always so great as well. And just, yeah, there's nothing, that bit when a whole room of people laugh and sometimes applaud, a bit that you've created, nothing else comes close.
Yeah. And is your audience, you know, because I'm interested, because obviously you're playing to two different audiences in the book, I think, and in the previous stand-up show. Is your audience mainly Muslims? Is it a sort of mixed audience, or is it?
It is very mixed. I think depending on the town you go will sort of dictate what sort of audience it is.
Yeah.
So if I'm in Blackburn or Bradford, you can sort of guess the demographic of the people that might come see me. But when I came to Chorley a couple of years ago, it was mainly a white English audience.
Yeah.
Or if I go to Bristol, for example. But then if I'm in Manchester or London, it'll be very mixed, sort of not quite 50-50 maybe, but like 60-40 maybe. So yeah, it depends on where I am in the country, the demographics of the room. But yeah, I've quite a nice mixed audience, because they've come from different places, like from BBC Radio 4, from The Fringe, from The Circuit, from Man Like Mobeen.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Asian or Muslims who can see someone on TV that they can relate to. I'm like, oh yeah, let's go see someone that looks a bit like us.
Yeah.
I've managed to sort of gather an audience from a lot of different places, which is nice.
And that's obviously important to you, I think, reading the book as well, that you feel that you didn't have that as when you were a kid. You didn't have someone to look at and go, oh, that's someone like me. Someone, you know. And so yeah, you are that to other people, I guess.
Yeah.
To younger
people. Yeah, and you get some very nice DMs and emails and all sorts from people who you've inspired that you didn't know about, which is a crazy, crazy thing for me, because it's not, I don't do this to inspire anyone. I do it because I enjoy doing it, and I'm lucky to make a living from it. But I never think about how it's received. After people have laughed, I've never think about how it resonates with people, or how it sits with people, or how sort of it's, you know, I'm sure you had the same during the pandemic when, you know, the messages from people telling you that you helped them get through some dark times.
A lot of people told me that I made it a lot worse for them. that made it brighter when they came out the other end.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
It's nice.
Just the stuff like that is very, very nice, but it's sort of a secondary responsibility that gets projected onto you.
Yeah. So you're not going to be doing any more A Man Like Mabeen?
Not that I know of.
Right.
Not that I've been told.
I mean, are they still doing it? Is there more coming?
Was a series 4 that I wasn't in, and then I think there are talks of a series 5, but my character is definitely dead. Eight is definitely dead.
Okay.
But I've not been told that I'm going to be playing 9 or 10
okay.
or 7. So as far as I'm aware, my involvement in it has ended. But then, you know, never say never, I guess.
Yeah.
But if it was up to me, I'd still be in it.
Yeah. If it was up to me, I'd be in it. might be controversial in some ways. I'll ask a more recent emergency question. Let me see what I've got in. Actually, my new emergency question. Let's see. Because I like, you know, you. Let's see if you've got one for this, because you're a bit younger than me, so it might be different than me. What is your favourite opening titles from a TV show? Do you have one from?
I have one from more recently and from yesteryear.
Okay.
So from yesteryear, Knight Rider.
Okay.
Oh, I love that Knight Rider theme tune. Yeah. Always thought it was ahead of its time. And also it was sampled in the one Punjabi song that everyone knows as well.
Okay.
So I do love Knight Rider. But more recently, I would say, what was the show with the vampires set in the South in America? True Blood. Did anyone watch True Blood? The titles for that are incredible.
Right, okay.
They're really, really good. And then Game of Thrones, for one that people will recognise.
Game of Thrones is just too long. It's just too long.
I like it.
Okay. I'd like just more, you know, incest and...
it's eating into my incest time.
People fucking each other and being murdered. That's what I'd like, yeah.
It took me about 4 seasons to figure out that whatever towns they showed in the titles was what was going to happen in that episode.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it took me ages to figure. I was like, oh, that's where we're going this time. Okay, nice. Bravos, good. Oh, nice.
Maybe they could just show the whole episode in the... It's a very quick version of the... just let you know how much you have to fast forward to get to the bits where there's someone's bottom. That's all you need. Right, I'll do. Let's. I'm going to go random emergency question, and then we. You know, it's been a terrific. It's gone again. Gone stupidly quickly. Let's see what we have. Not that page. Oh, that's that. That's a bit. I'm going to ask it. So it's not. It's not an end of the show question. Do you think democracy is broken? And what would you replace it with?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, no hesitation whatsoever. I would replace democracy with a benevolent dictatorship tomorrow.
Okay. Completely. Who's in charge? Is it you?
No, I'm not. I'm not that benevolent. But I think an autocratic dictatorship where they put people in charge of things who are experts in that job would be much better than the system we have now.
I mean, wouldn't it just be, it doesn't have to be the autocratic bit, just people who are experts in the job,
the thing with democracy is everyone just short-term thinking for the next election and what is my legacy going to be once I leave this seat? How can I win the next election? Short-term populism and all of that stuff, and I'm not into it.
Yeah.
Give me a benevolent dictatorship anytime.
Well, be careful what you wish for. The thing that people, you know, I think like with democracy, I would just love every vote to count, right?
First past the post doesn't work.
Yeah. And, you know, the argument against first past the post was you'd just get coalition governments. But we just have coalition governments anyway because all the parties, you look at the Tory party, it's a coalition of fucking...
Of cunts, yeah.
Yeah. But some of the cunts are really, big cunts.
Yeah. Some of them have a capital C. Yeah.
And some of them are just well-meaning cunts
who've
chosen the wrong side. But, you know, it's basically UKIP and, you know, and soft Tories and people who are basically liberals and, you know,
it's
a coalition and then it can fall apart if, you know, someone goes. So I don't know. Well,
I think with Labour, you've got the right side of Labour, and then you've got the all the way to the left and stuff, and everyone in the middle.
Politics is about democracy. Could work if everyone just has their say, and then everyone votes on it. But the party system is screwed. But are we going to change it, Chorley? No, it's bad, but we're not going to change. I don't think we are going to change it. Right, let's see if I've got one with cocks or shit in it, and then we'll that'll be better.
Also, I worked in the civil service for 10 years, so I saw very closely how things work.
Yes, of course.
Or not.
But also, my friend used to work in the civil service and left the civil service, and just, you know, absolutely worked with the government ministers and knew how fucking shit they were and how little they listened to anyone. And post-Brexit, like, loads of people left.
Yeah, I wrote speeches for Theresa May.
Right.
On modern slavery, not on... that was the one thing that she... So I worked in the modern slavery unit because she found this one area that no one would object to. There's no pro-slavery lobby. Everyone is anti-slavery. So she found this one area where she could look good in and be like, I'm stopping modern slavery and stuff. And everyone's like, that's great. And so she just used it as the one thing to be like, look, I am a human being.
Yeah.
But sort of, it was quite a nice area to work in because you feel like you're in the one area of the Home Office that is actually doing something positive.
Yeah.
As opposed to the rest of it.
I mean, do you think everyone disagrees? I think like the world's going to a point where some people are going, no, I think, you know, GB News, well, there should be a little bit of slavery.
Yeah, make Britain great again.
Yeah. Good, right, let's see what comes up and then we'll... So we've got the tour coming up. Is there anything else exciting coming up for you?
That SAS Who Dares Wins, that'll be on the telly at some point next year.
Yeah. Was there any toss pots?
No, everyone's dead nice.
Were they nice? No Matt Hancock in that one?
No, I had John Barrowman and he lasted half an afternoon.
Right.
I don't know why. He just quit on us and we were like, John, what are you doing? Maybe just like, yeah, he just didn't fancy it. And I should probably spoil... Well, I'm spoiling the series. But, but yeah, I didn't win, so I don't care. But no, just everyone's dead now. Everyone's just dead now. So a lot of reality TV people who, before I'd ever worked with any, I had a kind of quite a negative view on. Sure. But the more that I've worked with them and the more that I meet them, I just think, A, they're very lovely. B, they're very, very smart and very, very good at what they do. and just dead nice and sort of not very political in terms of like, which is also not necessarily a good thing either, but just very like, they're there to do their job and they don't really think much else about, or if they do have much opinion about the rest of the world, they kind of just keep it to themselves and are very just focused on making their money and doing their job. Just in a way, quite admirable. I wish I could be like that. Ignorance is bliss.
It's good. I mean, you know, I think you're engaged with the world and you're interested in the world, and you know, you can be outspoken about stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's a good. You know, I think that's a thing that we're losing from TV, because it's, you know, it's, you can't go on those sort of shows and, you know, and start saying the things that you want to say. Maybe. So. You know, it is, yeah, it's interesting. But I think you've got to keep that spark inside you, at least. You know, you're, as we're all human beings, we have different aspects of our lives and we don't have to. That's what your stuff is, I think. Your stand-up is that. It's, you know, it's not like going, here, I'm going to talk about Islam or I'm going to talk about this. It's, those are things that just weave through it.
Mm.
But if, you know, if you just got up on stage and talked about, you know, something seriously, even, you know, it wouldn't be the same as, you know, as I think you do brilliantly in the book. It's just, you know, weaving together all these different aspects. Right, let's see what comes up. This is it, make or break for this podcast episode. All dependent on this question. What is the most embarrassing photo of you that your family have on display? Can't think, that's not, we'll have to get it out and put it up. Trying to think if what I've got of that. Never asked that question before.
My, I don't want to ruin the vibes, but I don't have a lot of pictures from me as a kid because my stepdad burnt them all.
Okay.
Oh. yeah. When he kicked me out, he burnt a lot of my a couple of albums of old pictures.
What?
So I don't have a lot.
Wow. That's fucking amazing, though.
If you've read the book, he was a character.
Yeah, of course. But also, the thing I was going to say in your book is you burnt all your school books as well.
Yeah, I did.
Which is like, I burnt, the only subject I didn't like was art, and I was very bad at it. And I burnt all the art I drew at middle school. I burnt it all in a fire. Is that the same? Is that why burning your books?
Yeah, the reason I just burned
your exercise books.
Yeah, all my exercise books from school. Genuinely, the reason I did it is because my cousin did it, and I wasn't a very cool kid, and I thought, oh yeah, that's fucking cool, that. And so I thought I'd burn mine, and now I'm like, what a fucking dickhead.
Yeah.
Why did I do that for? Like, that would have been a treasure trove. It would have fucking helped me write the book. First of all, what a treasure trove I throw away. And so I regret that. But I just wanted to do something because I thought my cousin was very cool. So I thought that was a cool thing that he did. So I thought, I think for him it was a cool thing to do because he didn't really like school. And
he
didn't really get on with it as much as I did. But I liked school.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a cool thing for me to
That's
do.
That's why just that detail stuck out. Just because I'd done it on a small scale and I know why I did it. It's because it signified my own failure or something. Yeah. Which
just
I think
me trying to be something that I wasn't.
Yeah, that's interesting. And yeah, you know, that's... I kept nearly everything, I have to say, and most of it is not stuff that you want to look back at. Like maths... exercise books are not interesting from when you're 12, you know. Yeah, like when you're 4, you go, oh, look, it's when you're 12, oh, fucking hell, I wish I'd thrown this away. It's difficult to throw it away. So burn your books, kids, burn your exercise books, your school books. That's a moment of sadness at the end of this joyful.
as soon as you asked it, I thought, oh, I could just make something up.
No, I like that. But again, I think that's what I like about you, that you would do that. And I think it's, you know, fucking hell. but you just think about, you have to think about what kind of person that would be. You know, the minute you know that, the kind of person who would do it, because it doesn't matter, you know, you have to be a certain type of person to do that.
Mm.
And, you know, and it's a fucking cunt.
Yeah, he was. He actually still is, but yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So you come out well. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for the amazing Tez Ilyas. Thanks so much. Thanks, everyone. Hopefully see you on my stand-up tour as well. You have been listening to Rahul Astapar with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Tez Ilyas. Thank you to Scant Regard for doing the music. And also, I'm indebted to my producer, director, friend, Chris Evans, not that one, and his son, Ben Evans, not that one. Thank you to Beck Cliff, who's my tour manager, George Linkford, who's the incompetent soundman, and everybody at Chorley Little Theatre for looking after us for a second week. It's lovely to have us back. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out for a chance to win the French Open title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV, live in HD. Don't miss a moment with daily live coverage and match replays on demand, beginning Monday, May 20th. Be there for all the unforgettable moments. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.